This is the PropTech VC Podcast. We give you unique insights into how innovative technologies are disrupting real estate. We interview top entrepreneurs, investors, and knowledgeable experts to share the inside scoop in this fast-moving industry. It's hosted by leading PropTech VC, Zane Jaffer. Let's dive into today's content.
Obviously, the retail market needs to be broken down a bit to, otherwise we're making generalizations, but if you take some segments of retail that have done really well, like grocery anchored tenants and essential services, which have been buoyed by the COVID situation. And then you've got new types of tenants emerging. You call it cloud kitchens, you know, or restaurants that are trying to be more plugged into the Uber Eats style network. But then you've got the strip malls, you've got non-essential services that are really being hammered hard. What's done well and what's a good theme for the future? What are you bullish on in the retail sector?
Yeah, really bullish on actually the new food concepts. What we've seen actually in Dallas, there's a leasing agent who's a friend. I mean, she is basically all in on the retail food concepts. And it's been super hot in Dallas. We've got a lot of restaurants that have plugged into this idea that, hey, I can be a restaurant and I can deliver 30% of my food.
So you think the habit's set? Because we've been in lockdown for so long and we've been so used to clicking a button and having someone deliver food to our door, that's the way it's going to go? Or do you feel like that was a temporary thing and we're going to be focused on the dining experience more than ever because we're with a vengeance rearing to return to normalcy?
I mean, I know where I fall on that spectrum. I want to go back to the restaurant. I mean, I love people and love being out. So that's me. But what we've seen in marketing from people that, you know, do it for a living is, you know, some people have just resigned themselves, just like they have on the office side, to, hey, I'm going to just return. I'm going to be at home more than I'm going to be in the office. Similar to the retail food side of things where, hey, I'm just going to press a button and see my food delivered at my front doorstep.
Carla, are there sectors of retail that you think are going to turn around that have been hit really hard and you think are so obviously, you know, food is a good trend and that did well pre-COVID and even better post-COVID and through it. What about areas you feel like were hammered really hard and you think big money is going to come in and is going to turn it around and you feel like, okay, if you can just hold on and stay in there long enough, you will survive? And too many businesses did not survive. They couldn't pay their, you know, landlords and they've gone bankrupt and they've renegotiated things. Which areas do you think are going to like rebound completely and they're going to be even better than, not better than before, but, you know, they're going to really rebound from COVID?
I think there's a large appetite to go back. I mean, I look at shopping malls. I'm actually, our office is literally catty corner to North Park Center here in Dallas. And I think shopping malls still have a major opportunity. I still think the ability for people to go out and buy something like a piece of clothing or, you know, a piece of jewelry in person where they can touch it and feel it and they can try it on, that experience just can't be replaced by online retail sales ever. That's just not possible.
You don't think that people are going to do the casual browsing in retail malls and then go online and order it from their phone and Amazon? So that, because A, the item isn't in stock in the color they want or the size they want, or B, it's cheaper on Amazon. Do you not see that as a threat, or do you think that's an exaggeration?
I totally see it as a threat, and I saw it as a threat even before COVID, and that's obviously been even more enhanced. But I still think there's a market for someone to go into a mall and buy something. And even it's funny, we've actually watched as a company, because we're right next to North Park, we've watched the number of cars that have parked out in the parking lot for the last 6 months. And there's just been a dramatic increase. I mean, like huge scalable increase in terms of the number of cars, the number of people shopping in person over the last 6 months.
One major trend that's come out that I think is going to stay is luxury retailers who are selling very expensive items have done really well because they've gone to an appointment-based system. Mm-hmm. You know, you can walk into Hermes or Gucci or Prada and browse around, right? Now you need an appointment or there's a very large queue to get in. And so if you're going to invest in getting in a queue or you're going to invest in an appointment, You're going to get a more personalized experience when you enter the store. And retailers are actually changing their layouts as well. Retailers are making more, they're sort of adding more partitions to create more personalized spaces and private spaces because they've realized, wow, our conversion ratio is amazing now because every time someone walks in, they're likely to make a purchase. And we don't have these recreational browsers who are coming through and are sort of touching everything and looking at it and then, you know, leaving later on. Are you seeing that as well?
Yeah, well, it's funny. You actually, what it's done is it's actually separated your browsers from your buyers. I mean, if you're going to make an appointment to go buy a watch, you're probably going to buy a watch. Probably. That's just my guess. I mean, you know, it's one thing for me to walk into the Tag Heuer store and just look around. I can go do that and just, you know, spend 5 minutes in there and try things on and kind of waste the salesperson's time because I'm not a buyer. I'm a browser. But if I'm making an appointment, I have a direct beeline for that store at 1 p.m. because I'm going to go buy a watch. Well, that's likely going to end in an actual purchase. So definitely seeing that. It's funny, in Highland Park Village, speaking to your kind of appointment only, Highland Park Village is kind of the luxury retail location of Dallas, of North Dallas. And there's lines like outside of, you know, the Tory Burch store and the Hermes store and the, I don't know all the brands, I'm a guy, but there's lines of all these people. I mean, you like can't park in a Highland Park Village anymore at all. Not like they had great parking before, but you really can't park now because people are intent on actually going and looking and buying.
Yes, wonderful. I do think this trend is here to stay where people will be doing more personalized shopping. I don't know where technology fits in. You know, appointment reservation systems is hardly a sexy business in prop tech. It's very old, but, you know, reservation systems are being used specifically in like the hospitality sector, you know, to book amenities and alike. And in office too, by the way. One thing I'm seeing in the office sector, especially with large co-working spaces, is more room booking, more desk booking, granularity. So let's probably move on to the office category. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, so we're seeing a lot more, seeing a lot more leasing activity, which is a good first step before you can like make any generalizations about office. You actually have to see people want to tour. You actually have to see people want to get back into the office. And so we're seeing people come back to the office with actually decent frequency. What's really interesting is suburban class B space, small business office is booming, which is a total niche of the market. But we actually have a client on Dotted.
Is the word out or is it still a secret and you think there's an opportunity or is everyone now doing it?
I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine on that.
Why is it booming?
I think the
Why?
Suburban office yeah. movement, because these small businesses, they had, you know, 7, 10, 12, 17 employees. They never left. We had a client tell us on Wednesday that specializes in that type of asset. And they're acquiring space. They're trying to buy buildings. They're doing off market stuff. I mean, they have not seen leasing activity at all drop. Even during the real quarantine times, their tenants never left.
Wow.
And so if you look at that section or niche, which is very small, obviously it's not your sexy class AA, you know, high rise downtown. Clearly that's a totally different side of the market.
Father, what type of tenant is this? What type of occupier is this?
Typically family-owned small business.
Family-owned small businesses. Like, give me examples of a few types of family.
So gas exploration company, mineral rights company, group that's, you know, just a family-owned. It's been passed down from generation to generation. Obviously, we're in Texas, so that rings a bell for oil and gas people. But, you know, a group that has, you know, 5-7 employees, and all they do is look for mineral rights.
You wouldn't think that a small business can save even more money by going remote? Or are you telling me that because the rent was so low already that it was worth paying and having the office space available because there's a culture and that's needed?
Correct. Yeah, it's the latter. The rent being paid and kind of having that or the rent being so cheap and having that just be able to be their home base for operations, building that culture with that small business or that family-owned business, so huge. And so actually, in one of the assets, I'll give you a real stat. One of the assets, there were 33 tenants, so 33 suites. and 31 of them never left between March and April of last year.
Wow. Wow. You know, we looked at a few mixed use.
And I know that's a super niche stat.
No, it is. And you've got to really, we look at a lot of deals at Bluefield, and we had looked at a few deals, and we sort of just assume that the current rent roll or the tenant roll is going to turn over very quickly, and we're going to be left with this, unoccupied space. But when you look back over time, actually, it wasn't as bad as we thought it would be.
Right.
Maybe the government helped with, you know, coming in and pumping a bunch of money into the economy and allowing breaks on rents or some assistance. But also, I think landlords were flexible too. Landlords did the right thing and cut some breaks and allowed sort of, you know, a lengthier payment plan or anything like that. So that's good. What questions? Do you have any questions for me as a tech entrepreneur or even as a real estate investor or a prop tech venture capitalist?
Yeah. So I would love to hear just your thoughts on frankly, corporate VC and how. Corporate VC, if you ever dealt with that, number one, obviously there's so much, you know, there's so much talk about how do you get investment as a startup entrepreneur? Is it high net worth individuals? Is it family offices? Is it actual VCs? Obviously, when you start getting into institutional funds, they all have their theses and all this stuff. I don't think there's a ton of time spent on the corporate side of that world in terms of corporate VCs actually partnering with smaller startup companies, to really make things happen and enable growth. So we'd love to hear your thoughts on the corporate venture side of prop tech.
Well, I personally experienced the concept of corporate venture capital when I did my own startup. Now, this startup was in the marketing industry, but we went to the corporate venture capital arms of Google and AOL. You know, I mean, Jesus, these two names at the time were the biggest names in advertising. So that worked very well. And then we also went to a suite of telco companies too and computer companies. Intel had a venture arm, Singtel, which was a telecommunications company in Singapore, even Qualcomm as well. So corporate venture capital has been around for a long time. You need to break it down, and we'll talk about prop tech corporate venture capital in a moment, but it worked out very well for us. What we found is that back then, and maybe this applies today as well, you don't want your corporate venture capitalist to be a lead. Often a corporate venture capitalist is set up for most likely to be a lead gen funnel for the R&D department for potential acquisitions. Rarely is it we've got hundreds of billions of dollars on a balance sheet and we want to just create a venture capital arm, right? Usually it's we suck at innovation or innovation is very important for us and we would like to get sort of a view of what's going on. So it's a learning activity. So a couple of things. Be careful. And something I was very worried about was, you know, you're giving your trade secrets away to a corporate venture capitalist. And that's usually a team of people in a large corporate company who are tasked with investing in startups. So that was one thing. Second, I didn't see as much sophistication when it came to ability to lead rounds. The term sheets were very screwed up. We got completely screwed by Google Ventures early on, and Google Ventures changed very quickly over time and now is very founder friendly. But, you know, and Google Ventures are sort of, they've gone through a few iterations and whatever, but really non-friendly founder terms back then in 2011. And I think you'll probably see this from prop tech corporate venture capitalists from large companies. It might be the same. They don't know how to value things. And real estate is even more of a problem because real estate companies value real estate every day. Bread and butter, they've got financial, you know, models they can use to value a real estate project. How the hell do you apply that to a startup? So that's something tricky there too. So it helps if a founder can set up terms to allow corporate venture capitalists to sort of come in and be a part of it. But ultimately, it worked very well for me. I leveraged the connection with the corporate VCs to get meetings internally. You know, if a corporate venture capital arm is making an introduction, or you can name drop the fact that, you know, you're meeting a director at Google. Oh yeah, you know, like the corporate venture capital arm of Google invested in us. Immediately, they feel like, okay, great. You got to realize when you're selling to a corporate. We're not talking about corporate VCs here. We're talking about when you're selling to a large company. The person you're selling to is also worried about their job. As much as they want to help you become a billionaire and take over the world, ultimately, if they're buying your product or service, there must be an ROI for them and they must look like a hero. You definitely de-risk things a hell of a lot when you can name drop and say the corporate venture capital arm invested in us. Then it's like, okay, phew, now I've got an excuse to work with them. Now when I go to my boss and I go to teammates, I can say, well, you know, this is part of a, you know, the corporate venture capital arm strategy. So you, it helps de-risk it when you want to do that. But the other thing is, traditional VCs get nervous too, because if corporate venture capitalists negotiate some pretty scary terms and they have the right to block acquisitions, or they have the inside track to an acquisition, we were worried, well, if Google is an investor in my startup, maybe Microsoft might not buy us. Maybe Amazon might not buy us. Solution, go get AOL in the table too. You know, that way it's like, right, we're not just backed by Google, we're backed by AOL as well. And we have a program where we know how to work with corporate VCs. They're a tiny portion of the total capital stack, but they're strategic investors with no real control rights. And obviously we stripped away the control rights later on. At the beginning, it was pretty scary what we actually signed up as naive founders. Now, when we go to the corporate venture capital side in PropTech, you're seeing all types of actors in the PropTech ecosystem or real estate ecosystem step into the VC world. You've got large construction companies, you've got major brokerages, you know, JLL Spark, a top tier venture capital firm now, I would say, one of the largest, right? You've got the National Association of Realtors that has their Reach Accelerator. These corporate VCs are popping up everywhere, and it's very much needed for the industry to move forwards. I highly, highly recommend PropTech founders to bring a corporate VC into the round. Just unless they're sophisticated, don't let them set the terms.
Right.
Okay. Make sure the terms you sign are very founder friendly. Ideally use a YC safe note or some type of commonly agreed convertible note structure. If there's preferred equity, you know, I'd be a little bit concerned about giving up a board seat to a corporate venture capitalist. The other thing is this, because you're taking money from a corporate venture capitalist, it doesn't mean they're going to open up the entire sales channel for you. The corporate VC has to also navigate internal politics. You know, we felt this, Google was building a competitive product to us. Just because Google Ventures invested in my advertising company didn't mean Google would stop their own competitive, you know, thing.
Right.
And so you've got to recall that. And we never did manage to strike any meaningful deal with AOL. And I, year after year, I'd walk into those offices in New York in AOL, and I thought, because I've got AOL backing us, perfect, I'm going to be able to close every division within AOL. And no, not at all. Like, it opened the door. You still have to deal with all the bureaucracy. And in the end, AOL was a very low market cap company and, you know, folded into a bigger entity within Verizon.
Right.
So, yeah, very interesting question about corporate venture capital. Something people don't think about much. And I think tremendous opportunities for founders to tap into it, especially in prop tech. Yeah.
Cool. It's great.
Awesome.
Wonderful.
Well, Carl, this was a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to tracking your progress and seeing how you guys really, you know, become a big driver in the whole commercial leasing software side.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the time. This was fun for me. It's fun to get to do this. It's fun to get to talk to you, obviously, someone who's been around this space for a long time. So appreciate your wisdom.
Thank you so much. Yeah.